Away.
So hello, everybody. My name is Brian. I'm an alcoholic. Thank you for asking me to speak today. Thank you for the kind introduction, Jim. And like Jim said, as I'm currently serving as the Area 50 chair, and on behalf of Area 50, I'd like to take this opportunity to thank you, Men Who Trudge, for your continued support financially and in participation. You make a big difference in our fiscal well-being, and it's really appreciated. And as a result of your continued support, we have had a lot of participation. I see a lot of familiar faces on the screen today, so thank you very much for that. It's very helpful. You're helping us to do a very important. You know, I'm not so important, but like our general service chair says, the job that I do is, and what we do at Area 50 is. So thank you again. So my sobriety date is February 23rd, 2011. That means in a couple of weeks, I'll be celebrating 15 years. Sometimes that seems like, forever ago, and sometimes it seems like yesterday, depending on life, I guess. So I came in at the age of 46 years old. I was broken, but I didn't know it. I was an everyday drinker. I had a career that worked all different hours. So it didn't matter if it was morning, noon, or night. When I wasn't working, I was drinking. So I come into Alcoholics Anonymous. My profession was I was a drill instructor for the Department of Corrections, which is a program which specializes in the treatment of, at the time, it was first-time offenders with a drug or alcohol concern. And for the better part of, at that time, I had 23 years of service and was starting to look at retirement, which was a scary proposition for me because I knew internally that the only thing that was keeping me from drinking continuously all day, every day, was the fact that I had to get up and go to work. I was the kind of guy who had to go to work every day to justify that I was okay. The last year of my drinking was by far the worst. I was consuming unheard of amounts of alcohol on a daily, weekly basis. And I had perfect attendance at work. And it wasn't something that I was driving for. I was standing in lineup one day and they called my name and said, "Come on up," and they handed me a certificate and I was like, "What's this?" And where I worked, it wasn't a coveted achievement. When you're working for the state, having perfect attendance, not utilizing your perfect or your accruals was not seen as something that was a smart thing to do. But they handed it to me. I was like, okay. It never dawned on me till further in sobriety that that was one of the things that kept me sick for a long time, the fact that I could show up to work. That was adequate justification that everything I was doing when I wasn't at work was okay. So like I said, I was drinking morning, noon, and night every day. I thought that I had a really good handle on what alcoholism was. I made no bones about the fact that I was alcoholic. For in my life, I didn't know anybody who drank more often or more alcohol in any given period than I did. So if there was such a thing as an alcoholic, I certainly was it. I thought it was kind of, I kind of wore it as a badge of honor. I thought that I had to achieve the best of both worlds, that I was keeping afloat. And yet, I got to be drunk all the time. I seen it as a good thing. So I'm going to share a little bit about what, and I can't go back to the beginning because I always run long on these things and I'll never have enough time. So I'm going to start with my last week of drinking. There were some things that happened in that week, in rapid succession that were each one of them a normal drinker would have sworn off alcohol forever. I believe today that if every one of them didn't happen, I would have missed the opportunity to come to Alcoholics Anonymous. So what that looked like was the first thing that happened to me is I was served divorce papers. I had been married 26 years at the time. I got a knock at the door from an attorney. And I went out. He said, "Are you Brian Berry?" And he said, I said, "Yeah." And he said, he handed me a manila pamphlet. I opened it up and I said, "What's this?" And he goes, "My card's on the inside." He turned around, he walked away. "If you got any questions, call me." I was like, "What is this?" I opened it up and I read the top of the paper and I was like, "No effing way. No way." I felt betrayed. I was super angry. I couldn't believe it. And my immediate thought was revenge. This will not be tolerated. This will be, I am going to fight this tooth and nail. This can't be happening. The next thing that happened to me is my son, he was a baseball player. He was a senior in high school. And one of the things that his team did every year was hosted this fundraiser. And it was a spaghetti lunch and alcohol was served. The year before I went, I got drunk. And even after I received the divorce papers, things got real ugly at home real fast. And my wife begged me not to drink at this function. And that was kind of what I did. When I went too far, my wife would make an ultimatum. I'd back off. And then, I would stop drinking so that I could keep drinking. I found that I had done that a lot. I could pull back enough knowing that more drinking was to come as a result of pulling back. And that's what I did. I didn't drink at that event. And one of the things they did at that event was they asked us to donate blood. And I went in to do my duty donating blood. And the nurse takes my blood pressure. And she looked at me and said, "Are you feeling okay?" And I said, "Yeah." And she said, "You don't. You're sure you're okay?" And I said, "Yeah." And she called over another nurse who took my blood pressure. And the two of them looked at each other, and one of the nurses shook her head no to the other nurse. And I was like, "What is going on?" And she said, "Well, you can't give blood today." And I said, "Why not?" And she said, "Your systolic number, anything above 100, you can't give blood, and yours is 110. He said, "That might not seem like a huge difference, but it is. You should go to the emergency room. That you are in risk of cardiac issues or stroke." I didn't realize it at the time. Of course, I didn't go. I didn't go to the doctor for another couple weeks after that, when my sponsor suggested it to me. But what I realized was I hadn't gone 24 hours without drinking in about a decade, and I was immediately cast into detox. And I was having a physical reaction to not drinking. So that happened. The other thing that happened, I had a daughter who was, she was about 27 years old. She was engaged to be married. And we had planned since she was a little girl to have the wedding at our house. And she came to me at the bequest of her fiance to tell me that in lieu of my current marital status and my drinking, that having the wedding at our house represented a distraction to their celebration, and that it was not going to be at the house. And that furthermore, her husband wanted me to, or her fiance wanted me to know that based on the stories my daughter had been telling him about my drinking and its impact on the children, that I would not be spending alone time with their children, which they were planning to have shortly after they got married. Again, I had felt that feeling of betrayal. I couldn't believe it. My oldest, my baby, who, I loved, had a funny way of showing it, I guess, but that she was telling me I was basically out, and that the thing that we had planned since she was a child was not going to happen. Incidentally, it did happen. We had the wedding at my house. I was 6 months sober when that date arrived. Things got good for me really fast when once I put down a drink. I'll talk more about that in a minute. The other thing that happened to me is I got pulled over. It was for the second time. I can't remember if it was consecutive days, but it was, I had been pulled over I think it was the day before. I was driving with no headlights, and this time I was really drunk, so drunk. If the cop would have asked me my name, he would have had no choice but to have arrested me. Somehow I managed to get my badge out of my back pocket. To this day, I don't know how. I mostly didn't carry my badge with me. And I hung it out the window, and he cursed at me and told me to turn on my effing lights and walked away and got in the car. Now, at the time, getting a DWI would have meant it would have been an embarrassment, not only to me, but to the department I work for, to the family. It was a big deal at the time. It seems to have become more commonplace since, but it would have been a big deal. I didn't have any consequences that night, but every time I tell the story, the hair on my back stands up. I should have been arrested that night, no question. And many other nights too. The other thing, my brother, that happened in this same week. Now, this is a short span, maybe less than a week. My brother, who was my business partner, another thing that I had to do to justify my drinking was work all the time. I had to keep the mirage that was financial success, the illusion that I had created that everything was okay. So I worked hard. And despite my drunkenness, me and my brother had started a construction company that was doing quite well. It was doing so well that my brother wanted to quit his other full-time job and take on the business full-time. So he had a talk with his wife, and his wife said to him that she would endorse that as long as the business didn't involve me, that my drunkenness represented a threat to their family's financial security. And that she would be all behind him to do it as long as he did it on his own without me. And he came and told me this, and it hurt. The physical business was on my property. We had built a shop between my house and his house. And I could see the pattern developing, and frankly, I was whooped. Alcohol had whooped me. I was about 50 pounds heavier than I am now. I was mentally and physically beaten. I had quit drinking every night for, I have no idea how long. It was many years, maybe as many as 5 or 10, where I went to bed every night and quit drinking, only to find myself in the same spot. As a matter of fact, at that point, I had the lie that I could sell myself that things were going to be different the next day. I no longer bought it. I would have these arguments with myself where I would tell myself, tomorrow's going to be different. I'm going to quit drinking. And immediately, a different part of my brain would say, you're full of shit. You're not going to stop drinking. And I would have these arguments with myself about whether I was lying about whether tomorrow was going to be different or not. And it got to be so frustrating and so draining that I made a decision to stop trying to stop drinking. And I was just going to drink and let the cards fall where they may. I did that about 6 months before this time period I'm talking about. And things went really south really fast when I stopped trying to control my drinking. I just stayed drunk all the time. But the most important thing that happened to me in this week was one of the things that we did at the facility that I work for. Now, I had worked the 5:30 to 5:30 shift, which at our drill or at our job was marching, running, all physical push-ups, military type stuff. And it kept me in good shape. Well, about a year prior to this time frame, I couldn't do the job anymore. I had justified my drinking by the fact that I could go into work at 3:30 in the morning, leave for at 3:30 in the morning, and at 5 o'clock run the inmates into the dirt and do an hour of calisthenics and do it as good or better than not only the inmates, but most of the people that I worked with. And that I found comfort in that. That made things that I was doing outside of work that I was okay and I wasn't. Well, there came a time where I couldn't do that. So I had to bit off that 5:30 to 5:30 shift and onto the 4 to 12 shift, which was the ASAT shift. It was the programming shift of the jail. I look at it now like God put me in rehab and I didn't even know it. And I started to pay real close attention to what those counselors were saying in a different fervor. I knew what they were talking about at some point was going to be critical to me living or dying. I knew that a person couldn't drink as much alcohol as I did and avoid consequences. I knew there would come a time where I was going to take this information that I was hearing and I was going to have to apply it in the same fashion that we were demanding that our inmates were applying it. And then I would just take my discipline and my experience and just stop drinking. That was the plan. And when I tried to stop, I found it impossible to implement the knowledge that I had learned. Self-knowledge is not was not the solution for me. But what we would do on this 4 to 12 shift, when it was a 6 month program, and in month six, when the inmates were about to graduate, we would bring a speaker in from AA to tell what they could expect to see in the fellowship, what AA was and wasn't. And I had been a part of these meetings many times. I had seen many of the speakers come in from AA, and I was often quite impressed with the way they told their story. Well, when this guy came in to talk to the inmates, I was half asleep in my chair, and the guy told my story. He was a construction worker, he was a runner, he was a golfer. He had been divorced. He had three children, like I did. And as he went on and on, and he described his drinking, he drank like me. And the only thing that was different in his story was that he was there now telling his story, and I was there listening to it. I don't know if any of the inmates got sober that day or made a decision to do something different, but as he continued to tell the story, I made a commitment that I was going to go to one of these meetings. I had never known anybody who told me that they drank like I did and went to Alcoholics Anonymous and as a result didn't drink anymore. I come to find out that I knew a lot of people, especially where I worked, who had done just that. But a lot of people didn't know how bad I was. The people who were close to me all knew. They all knew I drank too much, but nobody on this planet knew exactly how much I drank. I hid my drinking not by placing bottles in hidden places. I hid my drinking by purchasing obscene amounts of alcohol and having it everywhere. Nobody could monitor how much alcohol I was drinking because there was alcohol everywhere. I had a keg on tap. I had a bar in my shop. I had a bar in my basement. I had a bar in my kitchen, and I kept it full. The guy at the liquor store thought that I owned a bar, because I would buy booze by the case, because he would give me a 10% discount. So when I made this decision to, as this guy was telling my story, to go to an AA meeting, the thought occurred to me that I had a tumbler of martinis in my car awaiting what, after that shift, would have been a 3 week vacation. I had 2 weeks time off, and I had a week of time that I had swapped. So I was about to go on, so I had this tumbler of gin in my car, and I had my first God shot on February 22nd, in 2011, in Brockton, New York, where I worked. The temperature dropped to minus 10 degrees, and because of that, that tumbler of martinis froze in my vehicle, which bought me just enough time to get to the road upon leaving work and throw it out the window. They say it's important that you remember your last drink. My last drink was about 7 or 8 years long. So that's what I remember as my last almost drink. It was the first time ever in my life I had thrown alcohol out the window. So that's what I did. I got home. It was 8 o'clock in the morning. I had been up for 24 hours. I hadn't drinking since I went to work. And I had booze everywhere in my house. And I had made this decision. And I was hell-bent on going to my first AA meeting. Called up central office. No answer. Got a voicemail. Left a message. Immediately turned back to the yellow pages and found AA in Rochester because I didn't know how to go get to a meeting. I didn't know where there was a meeting. I didn't know what you had to do. Called the Rochester Intergroup. Same thing. No meeting or no answer. Left a voice message. White knuckled it all day long. Made several more calls to that central office. And at 7 o'clock in the evening, completely out of my mind, my understanding was that if I was going to go to an AA meeting, I had to be sober. And I thought the only way that I was going to stay sober was go to bed. I was so exhausted that I couldn't sleep. So I jumped in the shower, jumped into bed. As soon as I jumped into bed, the phone rang. It was this young kid who had was 12-stepping me from central office. Told me there was a meeting in Hamburg at 7:30. It was as Bill sees it, and that he'd meet me there. I jumped out of bed, drove, and went to my first meeting, and have not found it necessary to have a drink since. So I hope that paints a pretty vivid picture of how alcoholic I was. Which is, the reason we tell that part of our story, that I have to tell this part of the story, is because my life today is pretty normal, pretty average. Considering where it started from, it's nothing short of a miracle. So I go to the meeting with the understanding that I knew two things from this program. One was that I had to be honest if this was going to work. And two, that I had to follow instructions. I had learned a lot in the program and thought I knew everything that I needed to know about alcoholism. So what I was going to do is go through the motions. I was going to go to Alcoholics Anonymous. I was going to do everything they told me to do. And then when it didn't work, it wouldn't be on me, and I could go back to drinking guilt-free and check AA off the list. But I wasn't going to do there having shortcutted anything. I was going to go and do everything they told me to do. This was kind of like the last idea. I had used up every bad idea I could think of, and this was a long shot. This was a Hail Mary. They told me to get a sponsor. I immediately started looking for a sponsor. I found one. He happened turned out to be in the same profession I did. It was somebody who spoke the way I was attracted to. They told me to get a home group. In the first week, nobody told me that you can only have one. So in the first week, every group, I was going to two meetings a day. It was the only, I couldn't be home. I had no wife at home. My kids were all gone. I had no business at home. I had booze everywhere. I needed to be out of the house, and I felt good at the meeting. So I took that meeting. We didn't have the app then, or I didn't have it. Took the meeting book, and I plotted a course every day. And I would go to as many meetings as I could. If I could go to three, I would. I'd get there. I'd start leaving for the meeting 2 hours early, and because it was something about being preparing to go to the meeting that immediately the obsession was kind of held at bay. And as soon as I was done after meeting, I'd stay as long as I can and start planning on how to get to the next one. They told me to get a home group. Any home group that I went to that said, you should be a member here, I said, okay, and I signed up. At the end of the first week, I had five home groups. It wasn't for a couple of years that I found out that I was in violation of some of our traditions, especially pertaining to the group conscience. And I had to make what was a really hard decision to limit my participation in the business meeting of these home groups to only one. A guy named Mike Donnelly from Abbott Men's told me that. I got a sponsor, I got home groups. I was going to a ton of meetings. They were telling me that the way I drank, I should go to a meeting the next day. I was kind of surprised. I thought that I was going to get some like special consideration. And they told me, yeah, you do. You get to go to more than everyone else. And so that's what I did. I can remember I said to my sponsor at one point, you know, I go to two meetings every day. You know, when can I cut back? And he told me it went something like this. He goes, well, if you're going to 14 meetings every week, next week go to 13. And then the following week go to 12. He don't cut them all out at once, and then go to 11 and 10. And he says, when you get drunk, you know you went one too far in it. And when he said get drunk, it scared me so bad that I was like, I rescinded my request, and I think I went to more meetings after that. I was like, I am not messing with this thing. Because when I had 3 days sober, it was huge for me. I was very impressed with myself, with AA. I couldn't figure out how this was working. When I had 7 days, I went to a meeting, and I went into this meeting. I used to call them the morning people. Where I got sober, there was this morning group of people and this night group of people. I went to this morning people meeting and got myself a cup. I had stopped at Tim Hortons to get a cup of coffee. When I went in, everybody in the room had a styrofoam cup except me. I had a Tim Hortons cup. So I had to fit in. So I took my cup of Tim Hortons, went over, got a styrofoam cup, poured it in, and there was a hole in the bottom of the cup. So coffee started spilling all over the table. I stood up, knocked my coffee over. This woman came over and cleaned up my mess and got me another cup of coffee with another hole in the bottom of it. Stood up, did it all over again. And the woman says to me, are you new? And I said, no, I have 7 days. Oh, she goes, oh, well, then you can spill all the coffee you want. And I thought to my, you know, that serves as a real good reminder to me of the love and the tolerance and patience that I received in Alcoholics Anonymous. It was always like that. People were giving me information in the most loving way, and pointing things out to me in a way that I could swallow. And so I kept coming back. About a month sober. I was just telling the story to Chuck yesterday. My sponsor said, we're going to a meeting at ECMC. We're going to go to this treatment center. And I was like, ECMC in Buffalo? We're going to drive all the way out to Buffalo? I said, what, why not go to this meeting or that meeting or this meeting? He goes, no, we're going, it's a treatment center. And I said, okay. So we drive all the way out to Buffalo, which seemed absolutely absurd to me at the time. And we're on the elevator going up the stairs. And I said, so how does this work? What are we doing? He goes, we share your experience, strength, and hope. These people are mostly detoxing. They're brand new. A lot of them have never been to an AA meeting. And you tell them, and we tell them our story. And he goes, he said, there's a speaker who does this. And I was like, well, who's the speaker? And he goes, oh, you're going to love this guy. He's from Derby, New York. And I said, really? I said, I'm from Derby. Where, I probably know this guy. Who is he? And he says, yeah, you do know him. And I said, well, and it dawned on me. I was like, no. I don't know how to do this. And he said, did you drink today? And I said, no. And he said, well, tell him how he managed to do that. And I did, and I was hooked immediately. I went to that ECMC meeting every once a month for the next 3 years. I can remember, and this kind of leads into the next part of my story. I can remember one time going to that meeting, and I had done it a few times at that point and felt like I was kind of finding my way a little bit. And after we got done sharing, it was like a standing ovation, and people were like unusually grateful for what we shared. And when we got back in the car, I said to my sponsor, "What was that all about? Were we did we say something that good?" And he said, "No, what I found out is that nobody's been to this meeting since the last time we were here, which was a month ago." And he said, "We need to go to one of them treatment meetings because something's not working here, and the message isn't being brought into this facility." I said, "Well, I thought this was a treatment meeting." He goes, "No, there's another meeting where they organize these meetings and nobody's showing up, and we got to let somebody know." So I went to my first treatment meeting, which was at the time downtown Buffalo, and sat in my treatment meeting and immediately was hooked to that. There was some people doing some work which made a lot of sense to me, behind the scenes in a very humble way, and I knew that there was a need, and like I said, things were getting super good for me really fast. And I was scared that if I wasn't doing my part, if I wasn't checking all the boxes, that this wasn't going to work. So I never said no. And it was out of guilt. It was out of fear that I was doing this, but I didn't dare say no. And so I got involved in that. That led me to be involved in a treatment committee, which later I ch became the chair of at the Inner Group, which led to my service in at the area level. I've been a treatment chair. I've been a corrections chair. I've been the treasurer. I've been the alt chair. I've been the DCM of our district a couple times. And now I'm currently serving as the chair, which was the one position I was really trying to avoid, but it's turning out to be like all the rest of them. It's got its blessings attached to it as well. So, I got the one other thing I'd like to talk about is, and I'll try and make it quick, this thing with my wife. I had conned, my wife had gotten this attorney. And she was determined. She was done. She had told me before, she had tried before, but this time she was done. And she had done a lot of work behind the scenes, unbeknownst to me, to make this divorce a reality. and she had moved funds around, and she had gotten an attorney, and she was prepared. The one thing she didn't prepare is that I had inherited a bunch of money, a lot about 15 years ago, and I convinced her attorney that this money was not to be a part of the divorce settlement. It was fabrication on my part. It was not true. All the money had been spent and put into community property. Her lawyer, who should have been disbarred for the advice he gave her, agreed. And the money that I inherited represented more money than we actually had at that we had at the time, which meant she was going to be homeless, penniless, and I was going to get everything. And she signed the papers like she had hit the lottery and didn't care. All she wanted to do was be away from me, and that really hurt. And I spent the next three months of my recovery working with my sponsor, trying to figure out a way to undo the damage that I had done. And I failed miserably. There came a time where he told me, "You need to just shut up. You need to stop digging. You need to not say anything. You are making things worse." And it was because I was coming from, I wanted it my way. On page 62, it says, "We make decisions based on self, which later put us in a position to be hurt." And I could not do that. One day I come home from work at 8 o'clock in the morning, and I'd convinced my wife not to file this divorce agreement so that she could have time to find health insurance. There's some sort of thing that says 1 year from the time of filing the divorce agreement, my wife would have lost our state health insurance. So I convinced her not to sign it. We both signed the agreement. She had a copy. Either one of us could file it. And I said, "Well, just hold off on filing it." And one day I come home from work, and she's in our bed, which she had been sleeping in one of the kids' rooms, and we ended up having sex. And immediately she knew she had made a horrible mistake, that I was going to perceive this as something else. And she told me all the things to stop thinking all the things I was thinking. And then it happened again and again. 8 months sober, this had been going on, and I couldn't take it anymore. I was this n this thing, it wasn't combative anymore, but I needed an answer. I couldn't have her leaving and then loving her again. It had to go one way or the other. And the Buffalo Fall Convention came into town, and I had an opportunity. My wife says, "I want to go." I didn't want her to go. She made me call my sponsor, and he says, "Oh yeah, bring her along. It'd be great. It'd be wonderful. She'd meet all the guys." And I was like, I don't know why I didn't want her to go, but I didn't. And she went, and luckily for me, it worked out that way, because the first thing, we sat through an Al-Anon meeting, and I was on step eight. I was about 8 months sober. And I watched this woman do a lead on what it was like to live with an alcoholic spouse. And I watched my wife sitting next to me identify with everything, all the horrible stuff that this woman was saying about living with an alcoholic. And it suddenly dawned on me, in a way more vivid than ever before, that what this woman was talking about was me, that what she was describing was me. And for the first time, in a very clear way, I understood the damage I was done. They had been telling me in Alcoholics Anonymous to pray, and I had been praying. I didn't. I seen it as kind of futile. I thought it was somewhat a waste of my time, but I didn't dare not do what they told me to do. I didn't know where it was going, but in that moment, in that very uncomfortable moment of clarity about what I had done, I had said my first sincere prayer, and And it sounded something like, "Oh my effing God, what have I done? Help me make this right." Coincidentally, or as God may have it, I was scheduled to make my amends with my wife, and that put me in a real good spiritual way of being to where I could be honest with my wife about this divorce agreement. And I had told her that if you needed to leave, that you should leave with what you're supposed to leave with. And you were free to leave. You had that she would have the financial resources and my support if she really felt she had to leave. A couple weeks later, she came to me and told me she did not want to leave. And we've been building a relationship that has been unbelievable. After I made that amends with my wife, my sponsor called me the next day and said, "How did it go?" And I said, it went good. He said, "Did you ask her to make her what you need to do to make it right?" And I said, "Yeah." And did she tell you? I said, "Oh yeah." He said, "Did she add anything?" I said, "Oh yeah." And he said, he says, "Well, it sounds like it went perfect." And I said, "Well, yeah, I guess it went good." And he said, "That's usually not the response we get." And what I was going through was that I would realize that the 1 hour of me apologizing to my wife was not adequate compensation for what I had heard that woman describe at that Al-Anon meeting, and that I was experiencing guilt. And my sponsor pointed this out to me, and he says, "Well, why don't you spend the next 13 years or next 26 years of your life treating her like a queen, and maybe you'll alleviate yourself of some of this guilt." And that made sense to me. They say you'll be amazed before you're halfway through. Well, I'm more than halfway through, and it has been amazing. I did not expect my wife to reciprocate. I absolutely did not want her to reciprocate because I wanted to pay this debt off to relieve my guilt, but she did. And that's how we live our lives today. She serves me, I serve her. We both get our needs met, and it's absolutely a wonderful way to live. We have a spectacular marriage. The children that my wife or my daughter talked about, they now all have a bedroom. My kids' rooms are now my grandkids' rooms. Not only I do spend time with her children, but we take them all over the world. We take them to Disney. We are the primary caregiver when my daughter and her husband aren't around. It's absolutely beyond my wildest dreams. It's a fairy tale ending. Everything in my life has been like that. Beyond, I get my coin every year, and I can't believe that it got better again. I tell my sponsees that I'm not afraid to go back to the way it was, because what I think the experience that I've had, I think I could drift away from AA and not drink for a long time. I would eventually drink for sure and die. But I'm not worried about going backwards. I'm terrified to miss what's surely to come. It's been a great ride. I wish it through the work, and it's available to you. I got a daughter who's 3 years sober, who's actively involved in Alcoholics Anonymous. It's AA owes me nothing. It's just been one miracle after another. So my time is up. Thank you for letting me share. I hope to see you continually at the area. And we got a big couple months coming up with developing our group conscience and getting our delegate off to New York. I hope you're all there to attend. Thank you.